monk who is asking himself many, many questions. And the hindrance that we may say he had was doubt. And he was just given the instructions, and he lived very far from where the Buddha lived. And so he had his mind turning around, and he was asking himself if the world was eternal or not, and if the world was infinite or not. And it was just such a strong urge for him to know these questions that he could not continue with his practice. And so he walked for a few miles and villages. And when he arrived where the place of the Buddha wasn't there. So he waited for 2 days, still with the questions. He had about a dozen more, of course, by then. And he then waited and sat in prayer. And as he saw the Buddha, he paid respect to him. And he urged him to give the answers. And the Buddha very quickly saw the restlessness this monk had. And very quietly said, "Did I ever tell you? Come to me, I'll teach you if the world is infinite or if the world is eternal." "No, Venerable Buddha, you haven't told me this. And did you ever say that you would follow my teaching because I would teach such things?" "No, Venerable Sir." "Then, monk, misguided man that you are, who are you and what are you abandoning in your life?" And he gave an example to this monk. He said, "Suppose a man were wounded by a poisoned arrow. And when the surgeon comes to take out the arrow, the poison, and the monk says, 'I don't understand.' He says, 'Yes, suppose this man doesn't allow to remove the arrow until he knows who was the person who threw the poisoned arrow. What color was the man? From which village did he come from? What was the bow made of? And what was the arrow made of? And what were the feathers? Which bird was the feathers from? Don't you think this man would be dead by now?" And of course, the monk was really completely startled. And he says, "Yes, he would die." And he continued his teaching by saying, "So although there are different speculations about the world being finite or infinite, about the world being round or not round, there are much more serious things in life. And I teach those and only those. And this is the truth of birth, sickness, old age, and death. And I here and now teach their very end. Here and now, I teach their very end." This is quite a statement. And he continues on saying to this monk, "And I have not taught what is unuseful. I only have taught what is useful. Because there is only the truth of suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path to the cessation." So this is believed to be the first teaching of the Buddha, which you heard the other night, called the Four Noble Truths. And I thought this story came up this afternoon because as I was sitting under the tree there, waiting for some yogi to come at a certain time, and that yogi wasn't coming, there were two other yogis. "May I come? I have so many questions." And I was asking them if they had interview with me today, and I said, "No, there's interview tomorrow." "Can you wait?" "Yes, I think I can wait." Which means that the story really came up, and it was such a similar situation. Although there's 2,500 years separating us from the story. And although our minds are not so different from the mind of the people from the time of the Buddha. And if we think, just how many thoughts did we have just today? And maybe they're still unanswered thoughts. And why don't we use thoughts with meditation? Why is it that the intellectual understanding of things doesn't bring to peace? Why don't we use analyze, reflection, understanding? It's just because they have no end. A question, a thought, brings another thought and another thought. And do they really satisfy us? Yes, maybe they do. We have a question. Come to the teacher or you find a book. There's the answer. And then you have another question. And another question. And this is not to say that the thoughts are not fine. But the thoughts and the intellectual process just doesn't bring us to liberation, to freedom from clinging, according to a Buddhist point of view, and I'm sure that most spiritual paths would say the same. It doesn't mean that we cannot make good use of them. They're very useful in our lives for interconnection, to interrelate, for communication, to speak, with science, with language, and even to use them as a prerequisite within sila, within morality. If you think of the precepts that we took the first day, they need some reflection. What does it mean to have a moral conduct? What does it mean to have an ethical guideline? So we use the thought to act in an appropriate way rather than an unwholesome way. So it means that we don't need to get rid of them and don't want to. Because if we want to get rid of the thoughts, it means that we're bothered by them. So it's not to say that we don't use them. They just don't serve the purpose we think they're serving. And often, I'm sure that since you've been sitting here, you've seen this relationship with yourself. How many thoughts have you had today? And how many thoughts have really gone away? How many times have your mind wandered and you tried to pull it back here to the breath and to the body, the sensations, and again, and it's a whole bundle of things that come and up. And this is the first insight, in fact. Seeing how much our mind is really dreaming, going off, inventing stories. And that's how we are. I'm sure that if you went into the streets of Jerusalem or Tel Aviv and you asked somebody, have you had many thoughts today? What do you think would be the answer? Well, of course I think. What are you talking about? So this is really a very special situation we're in. To watch our thoughts without having them have the power they have. Just not thinking rather than continuing the story that's happening. And we have a strong mental world. These thoughts, they make us run all over the place. How do they do that? They make us go back in history. Where was the nice vacation you had last year? Where was the last good meal you had, or the last boyfriend you had? Where is it now? But in a thought or in an image, which is the same thing. Or maybe you go in the future. Planning, anticipation, expectation. What, I wonder what this retreat is going to be like at the end. And who am I going to see? And what's going to happen? And we're already planning and imagining plenty of things that's going to be happening. Or we're here and we judge ourselves. We evaluate our practice. And there's no problem, again, to have the thoughts. The thing is that we believe in them. And that's the problem, to believe that they are solution to our practice, to our life. And in believing them, they have a lot of power over us. Why do they have that power? There's only 5 physical senses. There's smell, there's touch, there's sight, sound, taste, and 1 mental, which is consciousness. No more important than the other 5 physical. In that context. So the thoughts operate because they always refer to a known situation. And they make us hold on. We have an idea, a plan, we make up stories. But what is the reality of our stories? And how much do we grasp there? How many times have we tried to solve a problem since we're here? And the mind spinning around and having this conditioning from old habits, and yet when we want to ask the most fundamental questions about our lives, which actually brought us here probably, and it's just maybe why we're sitting here, is that we have this urge to find other questions which maybe are not responded by the thinking process. Does the thought reply to what is love? What is fundamental freedom? Can they be answered by intellectual ways of understanding these questions I just paused? I don't think so. And so what the Buddha found out is that by a still mind, a quiet mind, we can develop our own capacity to see clearly and directly through the thinking mind. And on to the truth of our experience in each moment. But we often prefer to hold on to what is known than go to the adventure, on the adventurous road to the unknown path, because it's scary. To know or to not know, and here in a retreat situation, there's space for it. That's exactly where we're working. Between the barrier, the borderline, about staying fixed on the known, and maybe give ourselves just little spaces to feel. What is it like not to know? What happens there in that space? And I'm sure that as from today, some of you have, from the interviews I hear, have touched those places. That's why a retreat situation is so precious. Because there's no distraction, no task that we ask you to do, no doing. And in just that way, the fact that there's no doing here is already a place of what exactly am I here for? Am I really here to question what I came for now that I'm here? And we can notice maybe how easily our habits are coming back. Just 2 days. to feel a little more secure, feel a little more at home, we hold on maybe to our cushion seat. What if somebody was sitting on your cushion right here when you came in? How would you feel? You already have your own space here in this room, don't you? And how many times have you checked the board to see if your name was there for the interview? You've seen it once, maybe twice. And I really need to look. Is that the real time? And so you fill it in because you want to know. Because you're just grasping for something to hold on to. Because there's nothing that we're giving you. And yet, there's still things that you can hold on to here. Habits that are so strong. And I'm not saying this to condemn you or to judge you at all, just to see it. To see how strong the process is. How strong it is that we're holding on. I have an example of this, very, very strong. I had, after 4 months of practice, of course, no reading, no writing, I mean, everything had been taken out of our room, not one book, nothing. And I was really into my practice, very seriously. And after 4 months, I was just there, finding myself reading the label of the tea bag. Lipton. But imagine how strong the habit was. I had not been able to read anything for so long. And I know that yellow tag very well. But I could have seen that strength, the urge, the need to have something to take was there. So we have a lot of concepts of ideas. We have concepts of time. We have concepts of ownership, of nation, of country. I belong to this country and not to this country. Of self. And they are all support on which the I, the me, can rest. And what they do, these concepts, because it's not the reality, and by practicing we notice more and more that it's not the reality, what they do is that they create a sense of separation. So again, we need not to be bothered by them, but we just need to be aware that they're there. Because what happens when we have these concepts and we hold on to these concepts is that we want to control things. We want to control our lives. We want things in a certain way, done in a certain way. We have ideas, fixed ideas. And actually, we can see that we don't control very much, do we? Because if we did control, then we'd have the world fixed to our own ideas and to our own wishes. And it's not often like that that it happens, does it? So we have expectations, and that's exactly where the suffering is. The suffering comes because we want to control what is not controllable. But yet we believe we can control our minds, we can control our bodies. And if we wish to stay healthy, how many days do we know how healthy we're going to stay? Or even how long are we going to live? We have no idea. But it's scary again. So we think that by controlling ourselves and the world, we're going to be able to grasp. We're going to be able to hold on. And that's exactly where the clinging comes from and where the grasping comes from. And that's the wanting mind that probably you've been seeing by now. The reactive mind, the desire. or the aversion. We want to control what we want, which is not happening, and we also want to control when something we don't like happens, we don't accept it. So we push it away, and there again we control. And I think that in the meditation we begin to see how much we're suffering by that. Because we're adding so much in reacting in that way. And that's the second insight. Because when there's a clinging, there's always a reference point. And any reference point brings us to a dead end and creates a sense of separation, reaches out. And the idea in the mind is that it wants something, it'll do everything to have it. Maybe there's a very short satisfaction if it's a eventually a piece of chocolate or a bottle of Coca-Cola, even though here it's a little difficult, even that. So we have it, we taste it, we've had it, and it gives us satisfaction sometimes. And then what happens? Another thing comes up. So this is very relative. And we want to change the situation. And that's the syndrome, which we call in meditation, if only I had this small thing, this life would be perfect. If only, the if only mind. Or if only this sitting would be lasting 25 minutes instead of 45 minutes, it'd be a great sitting, wouldn't it be? I have a fantastic example of this from Burma. I had this image of Burma like the most beautiful place in the world to sit and to practice. And this was a long time ago, so it was very difficult to have visa, meditation visa. We could stay a week for a holiday, but to have a meditation visa for a month was a very long thing to do. So I waited, and so you imagine the expectation that there was when I finally got my meditation visa to stay there for 2 months. And so I the plane, and I had a lot of expectation about Burma, I must say. And I arrived at Mahasaya Center in Rangoon, and unfortunately, this was a time where there was renovation. And you cannot believe the noise that there was there. It was just like being in New York, in the middle of the city, with the bangling and construction of maybe 10 towers. Awful. And not only that, I was from my room, and there was a room without window. And then I was shown the meditation hall, and there was absolutely 100, maybe, yeah, about 100 Burmese women meditating. Very nice. I sat. After 5 minutes of sitting, they weren't meditating at all. They were chatting in the meditation hall. And I said, this is not a situation fit for me. I've waited so long to have this time here. And what is happening? And my mind just couldn't cope with the situation I was. So we were 3 yogis from the West. And we had asked to have a separate place to sit, just to have some peace from the construction was one thing, but from the chattering, which was much nearer to where we were staying. And so we were given this room, which was next door to the elderly women who were just there as a retirement house. So they were cooking and chattering, and well, whatever happened. And so we decided to sit. And, of course, this was the rainy season. And so we had mosquito nets. Each one had her own. These were 4 people now, huh? Only Western yogis, women. Women and men are separate. And so I finally find some peace in my mind under my small mosquito net in my small room with the noise, but the mind relaxes a little bit. This lasts about a day or two until this Korean woman, who was also considered a foreigner for the Burmese, was offered a space in the same room we were in. And she came in, and of course she had no mosquito net, and she didn't know how. And she sat under my mosquito net next to me. I don't know how she found space, but she was just there next to me. Since I was the smallest, because the other ones were Americans. So I was really, you know, quite tiny. And so she found some room there. And this was just too much. It was just the utmost situation that this dream of Burma, where is it? And again, you know, if only syndrome, this is really the worst that could have happened. But I just coped with it because I knew there was no situation that could be better than the one I had. And that was such a learning, just to give up there. But I gave up after such a long time. It took time. But it was a learning. So it's not always the best situation that we have that we learn. So when we have this if-only mind, and if the reference which is not there is wanted, or if the reference which is there, which should not be there, it gives us a real problem. It just postpones life. It postpones life, and we're not alive. It's just like if we were dead, because we're just out of focus. And eventually the experiences are changing all the time. We get used to one, it's gone. Nothing never lasts. And that's exactly what the Buddha found out. And it's one of the three characteristics. It's the impermanence. And impermanence is exactly why we suffer. Because as soon as we hold on, the thing's gone. We want another one, it's gone. Yeah. And so we see this process. And that's why we're so entangled. And being here and sitting here, watching this process within the breath is very helpful because we see, although we even want to control the breath, we see it changing all the time. And slowly, slowly we let go of the process of holding on. And the Vipassana meditation is that relationship with what is happening. It's the sense of completion because we are in touch with ourselves when we let go. And then we connect with what is, and we learn not to react. We learn to not keep what is gone, and we learn not to push away what is that we don't like. And how do we do that? Just by acknowledging that there's no certainty. And that we have to face that. However much our world shows us the contrary. At least in Switzerland. I don't know, maybe not in Israel. Our world shows us a belief in safety. And it's incredible. And yet we have no guarantee. We struggle to find one, but we have no guarantee. We protect ourselves. We don't want to feel the fear. We don't want to feel the pain because it hurts. So the process is to really use mindfulness. It's the mindfulness that focuses and sees clearly what the direct experience is and what is actually happening in the moment. It's the reality of the present moment. and mindfulness. You've been hearing of this word since we were here. Has three aspects to it. Mindfulness has three characteristics. It has the recognition of the object, whatever the object is. It's allowing and non-identification. And you don't need to be there. As long as you're mindful, the mindfulness has the power to do that. And it's a particular quality of consciousness. It means that when there's mindfulness, we're being totally awake. There's no attachment there. No clinging. There's sensitivity, there's attention, and it has the power to cut through all forms of conditioning, of limitation. That is, when it is fully developed, when it is there totally. Why am I saying totally? Because sometimes we think we're mindful. Okay, I'll watch you breath. Or I'll watch you paint. But am I really watching it fully? When there's full acceptance? No. Sometimes we watch, and then there's the eye there. And you say, okay, I'll watch you. In order for you to go away. That's the bargain that we do with the pain or with the sensation. Doesn't it happen? So that's not being fully with mindfulness, present, allowing, totally there for the experience as it is. There's aversion. I'll watch you just 5 minutes, but the 6 minutes, if you're not gone, kick you out. Pushing away. So watch for that. Watch that mind that does that. Watch if that happens. And through a long process of mindfulness, we are really awake in each moment. It really transforms the quality of our lives. It frees us from bondage. And the retreat situation is ideal for this because it's simple. Only that. How could you realize mindfulness or be really aware of what is happening in your daily life? I think it would be very difficult. Or at least you could maybe start to do it because you have been in retreat and you know the power that it has. And this comes from direct experience. So there's not much distraction here. And you can really make good use of silence. And it helps us move from the thinking mind and the distracted mind to steadiness, to attention, to see things more openly. There's mindfulness and concentration. Concentration is the steadiness, the stability of the mind. Both. You use mindfulness, which helps the concentration, and both together bring us freedom, non-clinging. The quality that has to be needed is what we call bare attention. Bare attention is the key to this. Because bare attention explores and discovers the truth of our nature and the truth of who we are. And we become aware of them individually. Understanding rather than the thinking or the content of what is happening to us. Me and I'm doing this and this and this and I'm thinking and I'm going there. It's rather a process of thinking, hearing, breathing, eating, story, because we're not in the middle of it, and we're no longer the reference point. It becomes a process, and then there's a relationship to our life. Bare attention means observing things as they are, as they really are, without choice, without choosing, without judging, without comparing if it's better or no better, or if it's good, or I wish I had this sitting and the last one was really better. It just allows to be here and to be present and to rest with whatever presents itself. And that comes exactly with the balance of mind that can hold the difficulties and that can hold the unknown. The places that if we are in a place which is unpredictable, to see things as they truly are, as they actually are. But it requests a willingness. And that's the only effort that we need to make. It's that willingness to let go of the known. To really let go and to make the effort to go in frightening places. And I can assure you that if you leave on Thursday or Saturday, after 1 hour, you'll be just fine, as perfect as you came. No need to have fear for that. Our habits are so strong that it's not 5 days of meditation that will change your life or your relationship with your partners or whatever you're doing in your job. I'll read you just a and this is from Ryokan. It's a Zen master, poet also. He says, in the entire 10 directions of the Buddha's universe, there is only one way. When we see clearly, there's no difference in the teachings. What is there to lose? What is there to gain? If we gain something, it was there from the beginning. If we lose anything, it is hidden nearby. Isn't that nice? So the Dharma is a real treasure, because with time you'll see that it takes care of you, just like a mother takes care of her own baby. But it takes time, it takes patience, it takes willingness, it takes the effort to just come in here and sit and just be quiet and allow what is to be. And this gives the power of being accepted by ourselves. There's a lot of self-accepting in this. And it really liberates us then. Another thing mindfulness does is that when we recognize what the object is, there's also there, we have a choice. There's, if you notice before you do something, there's an intention. So we can use intention sometimes to see exactly. That's why the thinking is useful. So that we can use our intention to know if what we're about to do is a good action. And that intention in the mind is an inclination, maybe even before the thought is there. It's this energy movement which is there. And when we're really quiet, we can see it and feel it working with intention. So with self-acceptance, There is opening. We do open our hearts. And rather than being in our mind up there, we're more in our heart. And another way to work with that is by using metta, like we've been doing. Metta is a very strong power to balance the mind. Because I haven't said it, but it also is a practice of concentration. By repeating the phrases, we have a steadiness of mind, and it does help us have an equanimity there, a mind which is stable. And not only that, it also brings and raises loving kindness feelings for ourselves, to accept ourselves, and to accept others. And at deeper levels, with this practice, we can allow for very, very deep wounds and deep hurts of our childhood, or maybe of times we had difficulty to come up. But we can work through them in that sense because there's equanimity, because there's the balance of mind. And so then the fear is absolutely not there or is not strong because the equanimity is much stronger than the fear. So we allow ourselves to see the process and that becomes a real healing. So seeing the bare actuality. And that allows to be able to stay with the most beautiful scenery with equanimity, with no grasping. Just there, totally present, enjoying the beautiful sight. But without grasping, without wanting to keep it. Just as we watch the sunset, and once the sun is gone, we don't want to keep the sun there. Just watch it, and it's gone. Or we have the equanimity to see the most ugly sight. Because it's just seeing, without any attachment. And in the seeing, there's just seeing. No pushing away. Or no holding. We're not asking for anything in particular. And there's a very great sense of wonder. A very great sense of beauty. Of fullness. Of heart. Of being. Where everything that life has made touches us. Why is that? Because we're unified with ourselves. We feel as a whole, and we feel not separated. And that's what we call unconditional love. Love that gladdens our heart, whatever the situation is. And a very great teaching is looking at the nature. What a wonderful creation. It relaxes in simplicity. What does a flower demand? I've had great teachings from looking at the nature. One grows faster, the other one a little slower. Do they compete with one another when they grow? No. Just nature as it is, growing. It's like the innocence of life. And our mind and heart can really be open and take the vastness of whatever presents itself. It's just like appearing phenomena, like the blue sky and Whatever thoughts appear, they are only formations of the mind, the clouds of the sky. But we know the blue sky is behind the clouds. The clouds are there, they veil the blue color, but we know the blue color is there. And the mind is just pure. And our hindrances are just clouds passing by. So I'd like to close with a poem from Ryokan. He says, "The rain has stopped. The clouds have drifted away. And the weather is clear again. If your heart is pure, then all things in your world are pure. Then the moon and flowers will guide you along the way." So we'll sit for a few minutes.